for those who know every line, and for those finding Star Wars for the very first time, welcome to Growing Up Skywalker.
Welcome to Growing Up Skywalker. I'm Sam.
Hi, I'm Anna.
And today we are finishing up the heist arc in Andor. We are watching Andor Season 1, Episode 6, The Eye.
Would you say, Sam, that you are hyped?
No.
Hyped to watch The Eye?
We've been talking about this episode for a while. Andor is split up into like four little mini movies, each one like 90 minutes long, I guess. Closer to 3 hours long, but this is the final episode of the heist arc, which started with Andor being inserted onto Aldani to be part of a heist where they're stealing the entire Imperial sector's payroll.
For the whole quarter.
So it's a boatload of money. And after inserting himself into the crew and training and a whole bunch of other scenes on other places and now they've got an inside man and everyone's like finally getting to trust each other. They went up, they camped out overlooking the garrison, and it's time to go in.
People have got pre-heist jitters. It's fine. It's normal.
Nemec is like, I couldn't sleep, so I wrote how mercenaries are a weapon of the oppressed as well as the oppressor, and we can learn to adapt them. And Andor is like, the Imperials don't learn. You don't need to worry about that.
I was going to say Cassian, as the mercenary in question, takes it like on the chin.
Yeah. He also says, you'll sleep when it's done. And then we begin. So the heist goes off. The squad has split. So Vel and Cinta are somewhere else and they're tuning in their radio. They're in a little rock shack somewhere. And they're even like sitting there with guns out as a squad of troopers walks by saying sexist things and taking leaks by the side of the road. And Cinta's like, I'm going to kneecap these fools. But they do not.
Tragic.
The rest of the squad inserts themselves as an extra squad escorting the Aldani to their holy site.
They're squad 3. They're ostensibly from Alkenzi,
which is the garrison.
And it's so interesting how they just melt on in to the Imperial command structure.
So they're sitting there, and as they're talking, they're like, if anyone asks from Alkenzi, we're from the garrison. If they're from the garrison or from Alkenzi, we just sneak in. We have all of our stuff. And of course, Lieutenant Gorn, being the inside man, says, ah, yes, squad 3, you're with me. You're to escort the commandant. So the commandant, who is Commandant J-Hold, he is corpulent. He is expanding, according to his wife, when he complains that his clothes were stored improperly and don't fit anymore.
He's got a miserable family. Every family in the show is miserable.
He is like trying to get promoted off of this, and he's just super colonialist and racist. And he's trying to offload it to this Colonel Pettigar person who is like an engineer of some sort. And Lieutenant Gorn just is calmly listening to them be incredibly terrible. But the plan is going off. The commandant comes out. He gives the ceremonial goat hides to the Aldani leader. The Aldani leader says something absolutely horrific. He's like, our ghosts will have long hands and longer memories. And Lieutenant Gorn translates that as, may the eye find some good in you. And like, the Aldani leader notices, but doesn't care. This whole thing, the Aldani are giving like this ceremonial chanting. Things are starting. Meteors are starting to swarm across. Squad 3 escorts the commandant's family back up to the garrison. And as soon as everyone is separated off, the hostage situation begins. The commandant's family is separated out. This Colonel Pettigar pulls a gun. Fortunately, before the situation devolves, Cinta shows up and shoots Colonel Pettigar. Vel and Cinta have been on a situation where they swam across the lake in scuba suits. They ascended to the top of the radio tower and they put a device in the radio tower and then snuck away and called the mission on.
It is so deeply Clone Wars. So they scrambled all of the communications for the entire garrison. And then they put everyone in gags and handcuffs, and they march the commandant down to the vault.
And he's like, I can open the door to the vault, but I can't unlock the rolls of money. And they're like, yeah, we brought grenades. Don't worry. So they grenade all the money free, and all of the guards, who are like 10 remaining, because Lieutenant Gorn is a genius, are like pressed up against the wall. He's like, commandant inspection. They're all sitting there. And he's like, no, just kidding. Work for us now. This is a hostage situation. You need to move all of the money aboard the Rono.
So they force all of the guards to load up their own paychecks into the ship. They're making the commandant work for them.
But Lieutenant Kimsey, who is terrible and who is the radio station operator, is listening in to the communications, and he finally like pieces together enough of what's going on, and he can't raise the garrison. So he runs off and he sends off like runners to the airbase. And so he shows up 2 seconds after Lieutenant Gorn shows up. Lieutenant Gorn walks in and he's like, hurry it up, we're almost out of here.
He blows his cover.
And the commandant is like, you? You'll hang for this. Lieutenant Gorn says, 7 years working for you, I deserve worse.
And then the commandant promptly has a heart attack and dies.
And he's like, Lieutenant Gorn is yelling at Kimsey. He's like, stand down, it's a secret mission, don't worry. And Kimsey's like, I don't know. And then the commandant falls over dead, shootout ensues. Gorn is the first person shot. Falls
ugh,
down.
Ugh. Stop. I can't even talk about it.
The shootout is incredibly tight. It's very scary. It's like 4-on-4. Cassian climbs aboard and starts booting up the ship, but one of the guards runs up behind him and they get into a, you know, freaking grappling fight.
Yeah, he's like, you're stealing my entire paycheck, you jerk.
So Cassian is like wrestling him around. Nemec has to turn around and head shoot the guy who's wrestling Cassian. Skeen and Tamarin are trying to make it to the ship, and Skeen is blasting dudes, but he doesn't cover Tamarin. Tamarin gets shot down.
Yeah, Skeen does a god-awful job.
Well, Skeen gets like 3 kills, but they make it to, they're like, it's done, we're climbing aboard. They all get on board. So we've got Vel and Skeen and Nemec aboard the freighter. Cassian's piloting. Cinta has disappeared into the mists. She was wearing an Imperial uniform. She leaves the commandant's family behind, possibly alive, possibly dead, and blends into the crowd, which is definitely a very cool layout. Cassian hits the gas. The ship shoots up the ramp. The cargo is unsecured. Nemec is crushed by money.
Oh,
breaks his back.
You can literally hear his spine snapping as this trolley smacks into his ribcage. It's awful.
So Vel spikes him with a med spike to keep him alive because he's the one who knows how to use the space compass. And he's sitting there screaming commands, climb. The Rono lifts up into the eye. It's this massive, incredibly dense meteor shower. They're being chased by TIE fighters. The TIEs are shooting at them. Dive, climb, full climb, hard. They're going up, they're going down. Nemec tells them a vector to follow, and they point in that direction, and they're heading off. The TIE fighters cannot hang, and their like screens are being shattered, and they're exploding into pieces, and the freighter gets away. However, there's a contingency plan in place. Skeen and Vel and Cassian are talking about it, of there is a doctor on the way that we can take Nemec to. And Cassian just says, then we're going there.
Yeah. Vel wants to continue with the mission. Skeen wants them to go to the doctor. Cassian ends up making the call. So they put down in this lonely field.
Where a four-armed doctor is working on Nemec.
Did you know his name is Dr. Quadpaws?
He's great.
Incredible.
So Skeen and Cassian are outside. Vel and Nemec are inside, and Nemec is not in good shape. And Skeen and Cassian have a conversation. And Skeen says, there's about 80 million credits in there. That's a 40 million credits split 50-50. We could take the money and run right now.
And he is talking and talking, and the music is so tense. And Cassian keeps trying to not answer his questions and buy for time. And then as Skeen is trying to convince Cassian that they can go to a moon, they can split the money, Skeen will forget all about him. out of nowhere, Cassian pulls his blaster, kills him.
Yep. Then Cassian strides into the medical facility, sees Nemec being pronounced dead, and says, "The ship you have in the barn, I'll pay you $30,000. It's worth twice. It's twice what it's worth. I'm taking my cut. I'm leaving. Here's the crystal. Give it to your boss." So Vel is the only survivor. Andor is like, "I'm just taking my money and running, but just my money. I'm not taking, you know, the 80 million credits I could have access to right now. I shot Skeen because he wanted to split the money." And Vel's like, "I can't believe that." And Cassian's like, "Well, sucks to suck. Like, that's what happened."
Cassian is like, "You better think about the person you thought you knew and the person that you actually had on your crew."
Mm-hmm.
Vel forces Cassian to take Nemec's manifesto before he is outie.
Yep. And then we cut to the Imperial Senate as Mon Mothma is giving a speech about how the Gorman are being oppressed and blown up, and everyone starts chattering and leaving, and she looks at the news and sees a heist on Eldani. And then we cut to the ISB, and Deidre and Blevin are part of an all-hands staff meeting where Major Partagaz is like, "I expect all contingency plans on my desk at midnight. Nobody leaves, no bathroom breaks." And then we cut to Luthen, who's selling a bracelet to a bourgeoisie of Coruscant. It's like, "Oh, no one knows the language. You can make it say whatever you like." And then this random dude bro, like the son of this old lady, is like, "You got anything from Aldani?" And Luthen's like, "I'll have to look at that." He's like, "Yeah, I'm just joking. I'm asking because there was a major imperial heist on the imperial garrison there." And Luthen's like, "Oh my gosh. How strange." And he goes into his back room and cackles maniacally.
He just laughs.
Did it. Victory.
And then he sighs in relief.
Mm-hmm.
And we cut to credits.
So that was the eye.
So pros and cons.
Everybody dies.
That was the con. That was the major con. Pros, the rebels are about 80 million minus 30,000 credits richer.
Yeah. And they don't have to pay a lot of the peeps. So there's...
Because
they're all dead. So let's take stock of who's alive and where. Mon Mothma at her day job. Luthen at his day job. Deidre at her night job, which is also her day job. Cassian is in Quad Pa's ship, bouncing away. Vel is taking the money to presumably Luthen, and Cinta has gone to ground as a freaking horrifying rebel monster. She is scary.
So who did we lose this episode? We lost Terriman. We lost Skeen. We lost Nemec.
We lost Gorn.
We lost Gorn. Mm-hmm. And then Cinta is just yeeting off into parts unknown undercover.
Yep.
There's a screenshot from this episode. I was pulling our cover art for the episode, and there's a screenshot of Gorn and Skeen and Nemec all dressed up and standing guard at the base.
Mm.
And I looked at it and I was like, "Welp, all those guys are dead."
Welp. Yeah. Yeah. It's really, really sad. So early on, we learned that the reason Tamarin was so good at shouting orders was because he was a stormtrooper,
mm-hmm.
and that also Cinta just about lost it when she learned that because her entire family was slaughtered by stormtroopers.
Yeah.
So, but that's also according to Skeen, and it turns out he's a liar. He never had a brother. He's always been in it for the money. And so the lies within lies of who all these people are is pretty wild.
It is wild. I mean, I was finding myself thinking that once we see Skeen proposition Cassian, it feels like we have to then reevaluate everything he's ever said.
Mm-hmm.
So he had no sob story about a brother. He did not have a brother. He wasn't in this heist for the rebellion. He was in it because presumably he heard that they were going after a major payload.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem like he ever cared about Nemec. What he cared about was splitting the party getting them to touch down somewhere that the ship with the credits would be unattended,
mm-hmm.
and making off with the money. So, like, his whole thing about this kid is what we're in it for. If we're not in it for this kid, what are we even doing? Was just to separate out as many party members as he could.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he expected to be alone with the cargo ship. And then once he saw Cassian was there, he's like, okay, well, now I have to divide and conquer with Cassian.
Yeah.
So I'm positive he just wanted to get the credits and Cassian to this moon. And then he would shoot Cassian.
Mm-hmm.
And make off with 80 million credits all on his own.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, all he needed to do was to get the freighter up and running, because he doesn't know how to fly it, but Cassian does. And as soon as it's like flying, he could shoot Cassian, because Cassian's going to be like turning around. So, yeah.
He's just irredeemable all the way through.
And that's why Cassian shot him.
I think this episode further solidified what we've been seeing for all of Andor, which is how forward-thinking Cassian is. Because,
mm-hmm.
okay, so we kind of get the first taste on Morlana One when Cassian is getting hassled by the guards. He ends up with the upper hand, and the senior guard is like, no, don't kill me. And Cassian kills him.
Yeah, no witnesses.
And we're like, yeah, because Cassian knew that this guy was just going to wait for an opportunity to shoot him.
Yeah.
And then in Aldani, when he gets jumped by Skeen, we see him make the call to tell everyone that he's a mercenary, mm-hmm. and he's in it for the money so that he won't end up with a blaster bolt in his back.
Yeah.
Right? And then in this episode, he kills Skeen. And it's interesting because he has this thing that he does where he gets put in this untenable situation and he's like not saying very much and he's not doing very much, but his mind is moving a million miles a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And then before we, the viewer, are ready for it, he makes his decision.
Yeah. While Skeen is still talking and like, you know, there's a moon 8 parsecs away, we'll land there, we'll hole up for a minute, bang.
Yeah.
In the middle of a sentence.
And I, as a non-Cassian-esque person, would be like, ooh, maybe I can talk Skeen down. Like, maybe I can make him see reason. And Cassian is like, no, this guy is dangerous, and no matter what I do, I am dead meat unless I take him out of the equation.
Yeah. Well, where would he be there? So if Cassian gets up and leaves to tell Vel, Skeen will shoot him in the back.
Yep.
If Skeen doesn't shoot him in the back right there, then Skeen will shoot up the building or something, kill everyone inside.
Yep.
So he has the only way out of this situation. Skeen has put him in a hostage situation and like without ever pulling a gun. It's remarkable. And it shows what an interesting character Skeen is, because like you said, was he always only in it for the money?
Or did he see all of these credits rattling around and his greed overtook him? Like, people will just do crazy things for money. I thought about that, but then the more I looked back, the more I saw how Skeen machinated the whole situation to get his way. He did a horrible job covering Tamarin, and then Tamarin goes down.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has one less capable person with a blaster to deal with.
Yeah, and that's also very much Skeen was doing a pretty good job at shooting the guards.
Yeah.
He shot 2 or 3 of them out of like the 5 who showed up. So he was doing pretty good. And that's the kind of thing where it's like, ah, man, I'm sorry. I couldn't make it right in time. It was out of all the gunfights in Star Wars, this one is so tight.
Mm-hmm.
It's in this tiny room. Like, it's just big enough to have the vault and then like the subway car of the Rono. And a bunch of railings everywhere. And the bad guys are all in the railings. And they're full on guards. They're armored. They have their guns. They go to target practice. And so are the good guys. But the good guys are down and they're using money for cover. And they are all pinned down and can't escape. And it's not like the scenes in the rest of Star Wars where, you know, you charge a wall of stormtroopers and nothing happens. Or in the scene where Tala dies in Kenobi and the stormtroopers show up and Kenobi's there and he's like blocking shots, but they're just standing in a field shooting at each other and no one's dying. And in this, if you show Skeen, you die.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it feel very much more like a more modern heist movie with like the accurate guns and especially, gosh, everyone just dying.
It reminded me a lot of the train heist in Solo.
Yeah, which is the other best heist. And also, you know, had a major character death. Yeah, several.
I think the train scene in Solo walked so that this heist scene could run, in a sense. Yeah. Because there was a little bit of plot armor in the train scene in Solo, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Woody Harrelson is fine.
And we were like a third of the way through the movie. We couldn't kill everyone.
Right, yeah. So we lose our four-armed friend, which, you know, is a tragic tradition in Star Wars. But everyone else is fine, so they can continue with the mission. In this scene, there are no force users. There is no plot armor. One shot will kill you. The stakes are just a lot higher.
Yes. And the only person who we like know survives is Cassian. And so everyone else is expendable.
So my big question about Cassian, because I think this episode presents us with a lot of pivotal moments for him. Mm-hmm. He does just an admirable job all the way through. But I think we get kind of an open-ended question about his morality when he kills Skeen.
Mm.
Does he kill Skeen to save his own skin? Or does he kill Skeen to protect the work that the rebels have done to get to this point?
Or have those two threads been bound together?
Ooh.
Is that what Luthen saw in him? Is like, here's someone who will kill people, who will perform heists, who will do anything to hurt the Empire. He's not going to pull scams on other people. He's going to like owe them money. He's going to piss them off, but he's not going to scam people. But he will steal and kill and murder and assassinate the Empire because he hates them so much. And he brings that up to Nemec at the very beginning. He says, they don't learn. They're just fat and happy. They don't care about us. And that is the main thing that I think pisses him off.
Well, actually, what Nemec says is like, okay, so what are we supposed to do? Just lick their boots and be thankful? And Cassian finally gets mad. And mm-hmm. he's like, do I look thankful to you?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I think maybe I wanted a little bit more from the Qunari subplot in the first three episodes than I got.
Mm.
Because I'm still not sure that I have a whole picture of Cassian's motivations, which is why I'm bringing up these questions about his morality. Because I'm not 100% sure that I really believe in Cassian hating the Empire. I keep getting told that, and I'm not sure that I keep getting shown that.
I think he's on his face. He has this resentment towards them. And I think maybe this resentment, this anti-wealth, this anti-complacency resentment is what drives him. Because he does specifically say they don't care. And the fact that the commandant dies of overwork, which is what he was talking about forcing the Aldani to do, is this ironic twist, which shows that like Cassian respects people who work for a living. And he's like, his definition of work is very broad. He's like, yeah, killing people, that's a job if you get paid. But he doesn't respect that the Empire shows up and just takes things over and forces ideas on people. And that's like the thing he hates. And that's why I think that was one of the factors that made him shoot Skeen. Was Skeen's like, yeah, 40 million credits, I'll just live happily. I'll buy a moon, you know, I'll sit there and I'll just chill out. And Cassian's like, we don't get to chill out.
Cassian's like, we lost so many people for this money.
Yeah. And like, it's not like Cassian liked any of them, except for Nemec, maybe. But
who wouldn't like Nemec?
Yeah,
come on.
Nemec was a joy, but the rest of them are.
But Cassian respects sentient life.
He does enough to like run through the ethics of each problem through a very fine ethical filter continuously.
Yeah.
And when killing someone is the right thing to do down the line, and it's not even like save lives in the future, it's to like further the goals of A, keep Cassian alive, B, hurt the Empire.
Yeah. And well, Cassian never volunteers to kill someone. The show is very careful to put Cassian in a situation where he has been unwillingly forced into a high-tension scenario where other people are threatening to kill him.
Yeah.
And he kills largely in self-defense.
Well, so the scene where the commandant's family is sitting there, and the commandant and the colonel, who's like taking over, and the colonel has pulled a gun, and now it's a Mexican standoff. Everyone's pointing guns at each other. Cassian's not the one to shoot the colonel. It's Cinta. Cinta's like, that's a bad guy. Bang. She just headshoots him right away. And that is... But Cassian didn't do that. He had the drop on this colonel.
Cassian was saying, no one has to die here.
Yeah. And that is what Vel was all about. And that is like, because the commandant's like, oh gosh, the dialogue of this is so fantastic. It's so tight and so well written. But the commandant's saying, what reason do you have to let us live? And Vel's like, why? Because that's what you'd do? You'd just kill us afterwards?
We're not like you.
We're not like you. Well, like, everybody gets to live. Either we win or everybody dies, but there is a way out in that you get to live. And they were definitely going to let him live.
Mm-hmm. I want to actually go back to something that you said a little bit earlier, where you said that the commandant died of overwork.
Yeah.
I think that's so interesting because I think that is one way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And then another slightly sideways angle to look at it is that the commandant died as a result of his fat cat imperial complacency being shattered.
Yeah.
So this show is so gleeful about the Imperials.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we get so many interesting angles. We get incredibly competent, cold, calculating Imperials like Major Partagaz and Blevin. We get just dumb, mook, quasi-Imperials like the Mall Cops. And then we get people like the Commandant, who is in his tower with all of his buddies surveying the Donnie people that he has crushed beneath his boot at the Order of the Imperials. And the show is showing them being so smug about being colonizers. And he's just like the perfect example of a lazy elite, right?
Yeah.
Like, he has gained a lot of weight. He's horrible to his family. He's saying all of this incredibly racist stuff about the Donnie people. And then when he's finally forced to do a hard 10 minutes work and his buddy turns on him, his inferior turns on him, Lieutenant Gorn, he has a heart attack and dies.
Now, as a public service announcement, because we are coming into winter, hard 10 minutes of work for an old man, such as snow shoveling, is a very common cause of death.
That is extremely true.
But the commandant does deserve it because he is a jerkbag. So don't be a jerkbag.
Yeah, don't be a jerkbag. It's just like, it's so interesting. This show shows a bunch of colonizers in a room.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Lieutenant Gorn is the foil here. But like, do you think when a group of colonizers actually gets in a room and discusses the people that they're oppressing, is it like this?
Yes.
or is this played up for drama?
I think it's like this because so much of what people talk about is justification for their own actions.
And in the show or in general?
In general.
Mm.
When people have conversations and they're trying to get something off their chest, it's all the justifications and it's all talking down to other people. It's all mixing and matching. It's all like, well, of course I had to do this. You know, they looked at me funny. And that is what people say to excuse lynchings and racism and colonization and all these things. They say, oh, these people really need a firm hand to guide them to a future, and we may as well make some money on that. They're so inferior. And it's not that, if after you repeat it enough, you start to believe it.
Yeah. I guess I was almost hoping that the commandant was grandstanding a little bit for the colonel, but his attitude towards the Donnie, the native Donnie people, is so consistent throughout the show.
Yeah.
that I think this is really what he believes. He says all of this absolutely outrageous stuff about the Dani. They're a simple people. You can confuse them if you give them options. Mm-hmm. We set up comfort stations all along their 10-day trek, and we plied them with booze and distractions. And now there's only 60 out of 500 mm-hmm. that made it to the end. And he's like gleefully plotting next year to just cut them off from their sacred valley.
Yeah.
And it feels like it should have been played for laughs, and then it wasn't.
Yeah, this is the... We've talked about the banality of evil, and we've ratcheted it up, right? Because the original mall cops that started this entire chain reaction were just like on duty, drunk, hassling another person at the brothel. They were just like hassling someone at the brothel because they were drunk.
And like talk about justifications for doing evil. Mm-hmm. They saw that Cassian got served first, got mad, and were going to kill him.
Yep. And then that escalates into we see. So that is the evil of comparison, of looking and being like, oh my gosh, like obviously I am deserving because I wear a uniform and I have some rights that I've been granted.
Yeah, the fascist system gave me a blaster, so mm-hmm. I get to use my blaster on whoever I want.
And so now we get to the commandant who, like, you know, he doesn't need a blaster anymore. He has Lieutenant Gorn, who doesn't use a blaster anymore, who tells hundreds of soldiers what to do. He is the long arm of the law, and he's sitting here saying, well, of course I need to justify all this, and of course I deserve it. And it's most succinctly put when he's like, my belt doesn't fit. It was stored improperly.
Oh my God.
And his wife's like, perhaps you've expanded, you know, like, and he couldn't even fathom that because of course everything should be going according to him, and things that aren't going according to his ideal are heretical. They're problematic. They need to be talked down to. And so this conversation he has with the colonel is about alignment. They are aligning their particular race, they're getting their notes together. They're saying, we are racist in this way. We are colonizers in this way. This is the story we will tell. Don't worry, I've already vetted it. I've covered all the corner cases. We have no blood on our hands for this.
And what's so interesting is that they bring in Lieutenant Gorn as their kind of cultural ambassador.
Yeah.
To ask him questions like, okay, well, if we do this, how will the Dani take it? If we oppress the Dani in this way, will they fight back? So it's almost like they don't respect the fact that Lieutenant Gorn has this cultural knowledge about their colonized people, but they need it in yeah. order to make sure that their plans will go through without a hitch.
Yeah, and it's because they are afraid. They're not brave enough to cleanse the planet with hellfire from outer space.
Like slag it Camino style?
Yeah, they're not brave enough to slag it. They're not brave enough to carry on a long-term guerrilla war against a bunch of nomads living in the highlands of Scotland, because nomads living in the highlands are scary people because they know where to hide.
Except it's mostly women
children. They're not willing to... simply put up a wall and make it stop. They just want to steal everything first, so it seems like it was their choice.
They just want to crush the Dani beneath their boot heels into nothing so that they never have to fear them again.
Exactly.
I think Andor is so clear about the cowardice of the Empire, and I got that a lot with the mall cops storming Ferrix, mm-hmm. where they needed like 14 armed guys to go after one random scum rat. Mm-hmm. I'm using scum rat with air quotes, obviously.
Because that's what they thought they were getting into.
And
then they all died or were fired.
Yeah. And same on Aldani. Mm-hmm. They need an entire garrison of trained armed guards to let 60 peaceful shepherds into their own sacred valley to look at a meteor storm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is interesting. Nemec brought it up in the previous episode that a Surprise from below is more surprising than an attack from above or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of surprising to me that the Empire does maintain that stance, because what are they actually defending against? And I wonder if it's the Tarkin doctrine sort of trying to be a two for one, where they're like, hey, if you have a military industrial complex out the wazoo, not only are you explicitly defending a population, which is good, you can propagandize that, and you're defending against outsiders, which is double good, because then you can propagandize the threat of outsiders as well as you are actually defending against them in case there are outsiders. And then as a side hustle, you militarize your police force and you are able to just like have heavily armed people all over to enact your will. So, I guess what I'm getting to is that the military industrial complex of the Empire kind of needs to be continuously oppressing people like the Aldani, because otherwise there's no point to it.
You mean the point of the Empire is to expand and oppress? And if they're not expanding and oppressing, what are they even doing?
Yeah.
Wow. That's some real manifest destiny shiz right there.
Well, that is what it all is about, right? Like, if you have enough, then you don't need to buy more. You don't need to go to the Senate with an appropriations bill that is 2% larger than last year's appropriations bill by saying, oh, yes, well, you know, there was some unrest on Aldani. So, and it's death by 1,000 line items as you continuously flex muscles and expanded areas that you didn't used to. So you can increase your budgets for various things and increase the power that all these power-hungry sycophants to the Empire have. This is like, we see it in all the different stages, starting with the cops who are just like, we just want to get drunk and shoot people and not pay for stuff. And then we move to Cyril, who's like, I am a holy warrior and I want to enact the will of order on these people because I don't think of them as people. They are a disordered chaos mob. And then we move to Deidre and the commandant, who are like the same type of level. And they're like, I want more. Or the dude who got told to wear a ball gown to work in the previous episode. Like, I just want to be in charge of something because that brings me above the fray. I just don't want to live in like a spare space apartment with no art. I want to have one piece of art in my house. I want to have a spare pair of boots. And that's what they're doing it for. And then we move up to the actual movers and shakers. And we haven't even like met any of them yet on the Imperial side. We're still dealing with a Major Partagas is the highest ranking person we've met.
And that's, he's like, horrifying.
He's horrifying, but he's like in it for the ideology. He wants for nothing. And he's just like, he's fighting a battle with, you know, probably Tarkin for like funding. And he's got his own little thing because it's always being nipped at from the sides because everyone's always fighting for, jockeying for position.
Andor, as a show, is so crystal clear about the rat race.
Yes.
Andor gives us such a nuanced inner look into how the Empire has this scarcity mindset for everybody, but especially for people who work for the Empire. Mm-hmm. And they have had everything stripped away from them. And so the promise of even just a little bit more is enough to keep them scrabbling and climbing over each other. And for everybody, it's such a sad thing they're after. For the mall cops, they're after like enough money to go to the good brothel in town and drink. And for Karn, it's like enough prestige to not have people look down on you when they look at you.
To make his mother proud.
To make his mom proud, so probably.
He needs to be the emperor to do that.
And for the commandant, it's to get a promotion from one planet he hates to a planet he hates a little bit less.
That has slightly better weather or something.
Or something. Yeah. It's so interesting how anti-capitalist and anti-fascist and anti-expansionary Andor is, because it's just throwing the curtain off and saying, look at everything you're striving for. You're striving for nothing.
I love this. You brought up the scarcity mindset that they're all wrestling with, because at the end of this episode, when Luthen is sitting there, he's actually displaying that the opposite of that, of the abundance mindset, when he's offering this bracelet to this bourgeois lady.
And this, like, Hunger Games capital gal.
For real. And he's like, it's in a language no one remembers. And she's like, oh, that's so tragic. And he's like, no, it's not. You can say it means whatever you want.
It's your own secret language.
Your freedom is here. And, like, yeah, that's a sales pitch and it works. But it's that's how he is presenting these things.
The money guy has to have an abundance mindset, because he's got to make money out of nothing.
He does. And that is what he does with his arts. And also, you know, he's like, oh, man, I never want for money, because my dudes just stole 80 million credits from the Imperial sector payroll.
And so think about this. When money is in the hands of the Imperials, it is a scarce resource that they are all going to spend on nothing and mm-hmm. have nothing to show for. But 80 million credits in the hand of the rebels becomes a tool and a weapon, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of... if you ask the average American, like, what percentage of, like, their tax dollar goes to NASA or, like, PBS.
National Laboratories.
Yeah, or, like, the State Department or things like that. It's always off by orders of magnitude. Like, the actual money we do for funding arts and sciences is, like, it sums to less than a cent out of your tax dollar. Yeah. And then... the amount that we spend on the military is way blown out of proportion. People are like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that other than what's been taken out of it, to pay for wars, Social Security has actually been solvent and will continue to be solvent based off of its own trust fund. It's the military that's eating everything. And that is what these people are not, like, they're scrimping and saving because they've been told, oh, money's tight. Like, that's why we can't afford. It goes back to the temple bombing arc in season 5 of Clone Wars when what's her name, who was, like, sketchy hot, who got framed for the bombing because her husband, like, did it, was sitting there and she's like, we are down in the slums of Coruscant. There's no food. There's no electricity. There's no water. And Padme's handmaiden also had that same story. And these people have been living with deprivation for so long because the Empire is using it to fund, like, I don't know, Sith getaways on Mortis or whatever. They're doing all these incredibly expensive things, like building Star Destroyers all the time.
Buying Supreme Court justices.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, do they even have a court?
They don't. No, yeah. The Senate. We saw this. Mm-hmm. We saw this in the Jedi Temple bombing arc as well with Ahsoka's trial. The Senate.
Yeah.
The Senate handles it. I'm actually so glad that you brought up military funding because I wanted to talk about the amount of money that goes into military funding versus medical science. Do you remember? I can't remember if we talked about this in our Revenge of the Sith episode or not.
Oh, right.
But this has come up in casual conversation between you and me since, because this is what we talk about in our free time. Do you remember when we talked about how the Republic funneled so much money and Star Wars Society has funneled so much money into military science that we're looking at a futuristic society where near instantaneous space travel is possible, and yet it's possible for a woman to die in childbirth?
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
What was your thing about that exactly?
That it's as if the military technology had gotten just a few steps ahead of all the other technology, and then it monopolized the technological breakthroughs of the whole galaxy. And part of that is due to the fact that, like, once you have an arms race, everyone has to catch up in one way or the other. I read an absolutely fantastic book years ago called Dreadnought, and it was about the first Dreadnought battleship, which Britain built in 1905, which completely changed the landscape, and how multiple other countries nearly bankrupted themselves trying to build one of these ships years behind, because it takes like 2 to 5 years to build a battleship, years behind what the British had, because they couldn't not. they had to keep up.
Mm-hmm.
And what that meant was that all that money that they could have spent in 1905, a critical year for spending, you could be building airplanes, you could be building roads, you could be building nuclear research facilities, because that was all ready in 1905. You could be building solar panels in 1905.
Vehicles that run off of vegetable oil was a thing in 1905.
Electric cars were a thing in 1905.
Yeah.
You could be doing those, or you could build dreadnoughts.
And that's how the rat race hurts everybody.
And these countries are sitting here and they're saying, oh, well, we have to keep up. And like, what is the empire even keeping up with? But they still have this scarcity mindset of, we have to have security, we have to have order, we have to have peace, and those things are not cheap.
Well, and also, then you have people like Nemec dying on a medical table, and people like Padme dying in childbirth. And I feel like in our society, in the year of our Lord 2023, I think both of those things could have been fixed in surgery.
They say in surgery that, you know, you're not dead until you're warm and dead. Like if you make it to a medical facility within 2 hours, you are almost certainly going to live, as long as you don't have like severe brain damage, but like gunshot wounds, broken backs, complications from childbirth. Now, granted, people do die on operating tables a fair bit.
A lot of women do still die in childbirth, but, you know, we don't have the kind of technology that we see in Star Wars. And so it's not a great comparison.
Yeah, because they have back-to-tanks where they're just like, here, sit this jacuzzi for an hour and you'll be all better.
Yeah, so it almost feels to me like in Star Wars medical science, unless you have a back-to-tank, you're SOL.
You know, maybe that's actually, it is also a sense of complacency. And I think that's another theme of this episode. But the complacency of, if the Bacta, which is like a magical panacea that fixes everything, if that's tightly controlled, then the only non-controlled options you have are like surgery, which is in fact dangerous.
Right. So if Star Wars were in an equitable society, everyone would have a Bacta tank available at all times. It would just be the thing that you do. Oh, you scrape your knee, you go stick it in Bacta for 5 minutes. Oh, you're hemorrhaging on the operation table, we will dump you into a Bacta tank.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that Bacta tanks are rare and hard to find makes me think that they are controlled, which means that whoever is in power at any point has made Bacta tanks a luxury for the elite.
I have been carrying a flame ever since Ahsoka booted up, which has recently finished, which is that Dave Filoni and hopefully like Tony Gilroy, because I think he's doing a fantastic job on Andor, get together and make a half sequel trilogy set, you know, in the Mando Ahsoka era. And they could grab elements from the Rogue Squadron books and the Heir to the Empire trilogy, because those mesh together very well. And one of them is the Bacta War, and how going back and forth over Bacta only being available from a certain planet, which was colonized, and the aliens are like, we'll make as much of it as you want. And their human overlords are like, no.
Wait, is this canon?
No, it's not, unfortunately. Okay. But it would be a really cool story because it deals with this, and it would, like so many things in Star Wars, fill in the holes and make things feel more realistic.
Mm-hmm.
The complacency in medical science, the complacency that the Imperials have, and the complacency that Skeen was willing to exhibit, because Cassian was in, he's like, I will take 200. I have 200K in debts. So I'll just pay that off and keep fighting. And Skeen's like, no, take 40 million and retire. I think that is what everyone who lived wanted to do in this. Everyone wants to keep fighting. The fight hasn't shaken out yet. And I think that's what Luthen is vibing with at the end. He's like, game on.
Well, so if complacency is the major theme of the Empire, then I would say dogged determination would have to be what the rebels are showcasing, just like a perfect, neat foil, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Empire has all of the money, all of the technology, all of the power. And so the only thing that the rebels have left is dedication to the cause, except now they have resources. They're evening the fight a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I have no idea how much 80 million credits is. I've been playing the Saga Edition role-playing game with the FSF Popcast dudes. And with $80 million, I could outfit 40 blockade runners, which is enough to definitely bring down a Star Destroyer. That's a lot.
Well, so let's talk about what we know about credits just from Andor. We know that Cassian could have gotten a secret ride off of Ferrix for 900 credits, and he talked the guy down to 700.
Yeah, something like that.
He was extremely excited to get 40,000 credits for the Starpath unit, and now he was sitting on 80 million.
There exists a linearity to money, which is novel.
Unpack that.
Okay. So, like, 300 years ago, if you were a serf, and so I've read Thomas Piketty's Capitalism in the 21st Century talks about this a lot, and it's really interesting because you can go back and read like Anna Karenina, and you see that the serfs on Levin's farm together make however many rubles per year, and then Levin goes and spends that in one night.
Oof.
And it's because, and he's just like trying to keep up with the Joneses, but the Joneses have already like triple leveraged all their things and they owe everyone all the money. And the thing is that at a rural level, money goes further. And fundamentally, Star Wars is rural. Everyone's a farmer. And so we, as a mostly urbanized society in the United States, and really the whole world at this point, pretty much is like genuinely, generally urbanized. We think that like 80 million credits, 80 million dollars, 80 million rubles is 80 million. It has the purchasing power 80 million times that of one ruble, $1. But that has not always been true because the more you live off the land, the less value money has in the long term.
The fewer coins you need and the more things you can trade for or barter with, like you can use, I don't know, bushels of corn.
Just labor, yeah.
Yeah, or labor.
So that actually fits in with Piketty's thesis, which is that the rate of return on capital versus the rate of return on labor is distinctly out of skew in the world in the 21st century. Mm. And when it's in skew, then money, like a stupid huge amount of money is like, is worth much, much, much more than it seems. So take the curve that you're seeing in your mind of here's a point at the origin of $0 is $0, and here's 80 million credits is 80 million credits. And instead of drawing a straight line, draw an exponential line.
So wait, does the curve go?
It starts low and then goes up fast.
So it looks, okay, so it looks like a pregnant belly. It's convex.
Yes, but the belly is facing, I mean, the a pregnant belly of someone doing a push-up. It's like it curves up rapidly at the end. So $80 million is worth like 10 times $70 million.
So an exponential rise.
Yes, it's an exponential rise.
Okay.
And that is because the rate of return on capital is actually low in the Star Wars universe. And we've known this for a while. This is deep cuts. We've known this for a while because the banking clan.
Oh my God, back to the Clone Wars.
Back to the Clone Wars. The banking clan held everything all together at zero interest.
What?
And zero interest means that you don't have innate inflation. The point of inflation, and this is why in the post-World War II era, most countries keep their inflation rates at like 2 to 3%, is because that means that you can outpace interest. You print money at a rate that outpaces interest and governments get free money. But in Star Wars, they don't have that and they have to tax their people, which means that small amounts of money are worth proportionally more. Large amounts of money are worth proportionally much, much, much more.
Do you know who would be so proud that we're having this conversation on the podcast?
Who's that?
George Lucas. George Lucas's favorite Clone Wars arcs. And we know this. We know this factually.
Yeah, yeah.
His favorite two Clone Wars arcs are the D-Squad arc.
Classic.
Where the droids are running around the desert. It is the most hated Clone Wars arc of history. His other favorite arc is the funding the war arc with Padme, where they're fighting over military expenditures.
Not to mention the fact that when George Lucas was asked to tell a story, and he is a storyteller and a world builder. That's his profession. And
he chose to talk about government economic policy.
He chose to start with a trade dispute.
Ooh, in Phantom Menace.
In Phantom Menace, it all boils down to a trade dispute.
Whoa.
It does all come down to money, and the money it takes to fund, you know, the invasion of Naboo in Phantom Menace, that's probably 80 million credits, you know, and Naboo's in the hook for 80 million credits. But then we can put those numbers here. In episode one of Andor, Andor is being shaken down for like 600 credits. And we think, oh, that's $600. That's a lot of money.
It's actually 300.
300. That's a lot of money. That's about how much money I would personally expect to pay two cops who are holding a gun to my head to just let me go, no questions asked.
Yeah, that's a lot of money for me to have just walking around.
Yeah. But then $80 million is enough to take over a planet.
Or buy a moon.
Or buy a moon, yeah.
And live on it in a palace.
Mm-hmm.
So, by yourself.
So there's a very, it's a different relationship between small and large sums of money based off of the purchasing power, because labor is worth more than capital and labor is cheap in the Star Wars universe.
You know what I just remembered? We haven't heard about Cassian's sister in six episodes. I just remember that he got shaken down by the mall cops after he was looking for his sister. Are we ever gonna hear about her?
Well, that would be a spoiler if I told you, or if I told you we didn't talk about her, so I'm not gonna tell you.
Okay, I just was thinking about the reason that we got here in the first place.
Do you think that Cassian getting into this whole mess because of his sister is one of the other reasons why he shot Skeen when he realized Skeen didn't have a brother?
Like his feelings were manipulated,
yeah.
And Skeen pushed a button that he had no right to push.
He's like, I also have a sibling who was destroyed by the Empire. And Cassian's like, yo, me too. That is actually something we can bond on. And Skeen's like, haha, JK, LOL. And Cassian's like, I was already planning on shooting you. So now it seems like a perfectly good time.
Ooh, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't think I had processed how dark it is that Cassian's sister was working in a brothel. And that's where he had to go to find her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah.
Not to completely derail our fascinating macroeconomic discussion. I was reminded about the human element of Andor, which I see really clearly in a lot of the women's storylines.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm completely derailing us now, so I apologize for that. But did you notice that there's no female guards on Aldani?
Mm-hmm.
So when Cinta is blending into the crowd in her Imperial uniform, is she going to be okay? People are going to know immediately that she doesn't belong there.
She's an officer, which I think is different than like a stormtrooper. And maybe that's the case. Because we did see that Tala was an Imperial officer.
We did.
Yeah.
Deidre's an Imperial officer. I'm fascinated by the blend of high level government and military bureaucracy that Andor gives us. And then it's grounded in human suffering and mm-hmm. human stakes. And when I thought about Cassian's sister and when I thought about Cinta being in danger, I just was reminded about the human toll.
Yeah.
That we also see.
Yeah, we really do.
Maybe that's why this show scratches that itch in our brains. Like it's hitting all the notes for me. It's pushing all my buttons.
It's a call to action. And that's actually kind of like getting me going here. We record on Sunday mornings. I woke up this morning. I'm like all amped up. I'm all amped up for various reasons. But one of them might be Andor has given me this like drive to enact change, you know?
Yeah.
Make stuff happen.
I don't want to be like Mon Mothma in the Senate giving my speech to a bunch of disengaged politicians. Like, I want to be on the ground doing what the heist crew is doing, you know, maybe not pulling heists. I don't think that really suits my skill set, but like mm-hmm. doing something tangible.
You know, we had a conversation yesterday about that when we were walking down the street and there was some injustice that really cheesed us off.
Yeah. And then we can finish up. A Jimmy John's driver got in an accident with someone on the street, like their vehicle
mm-hmm.
was damaged. And we were talking about how the costs of that personal vehicle being used for a gig economy job are probably not going to be covered by Jimmy John's. And a person who's doing Jimmy John's deliveries in a personal vehicle is probably not in a position to fix their totaled car.
Yeah.
And the injustices of passing on the cost of your business to gig employees should be illegal. And there are no protections for the lowest paid workers in our society. And I was like, I want to do something about this, but the person who probably is best suited to do something about it is a lawyer who can take Jimmy John's to court and like establish more worker protections across the board in the US.
And maybe they do pay it, but I don't, I kind of doubt it. But that's also like, that is what Mon Mothma is doing, right? She is the one who's attempting to establish more worker protections.
She is, yeah. So we need both. We need top-down change. We need grassroots change. And we need people at all levels of government and
society
to be pitching in to do things for the benefit of all.
Yeah.
So I think we are seeing that for the rebellion in Star Wars, which is fascinating and great and cool and keeps it from feeling hopeless. And I think that's why Luthen was laughing, you know, because now they did something amazing. He feels hopeful.
Yeah, he's happy. He's like, I did the thing. The thing has been done.
The heist crew, less happy. But yeah. I think this was overall a win for the rebels.
I think so too. And the heist crew also, in a situation like this, when you put yourself into danger, there is the inherent risk. And, you know, it's not like they did any one thing wrong. They did about five minor things wrong. And that just happened to stack up to be a cascade, which let them win with losses. And I think that is what they all signed up for. And I think that's important to note, too. Good guys win.
At least in this episode, the good guys had a win.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about your favorite good guy?
Let's do it. It's
Let's time do for Baywatch.
All right. Who is your favorite heisty or heistor or heistexidor?
Cassian, duh.
Okay. Good
There's choice. No other choices this episode. It's definitely Cassian.
Gets the job done.
Gosh, Cassian just takes charge at every level of this operation. He is in it to win it. He doesn't need any warm-up time. I mean, he yeets that freighter out of the tunnel like a pinball machine.
Just full send on the freighter.
Full send. He just hawked it.
Hold on.
Did he potentially kill Nemec? Maybe. Maybe not.
Yeah, you know, yeah, tough to say. Tough to say.
We might have to talk about that later. I feel like Nemec's entire death was deeply sus, but that's a topic for another time. The other reason that I picked Cassian is not just because as a Capricorn, I love to see people excelling. It's also for that thing that Skeen says to him. He's like, you're just like me. We were born in the hole and all we know is climbing over someone else to get out. And then Cassian is like, you know what? Deuces. Ciao. I do not believe in that. Like, I'm going to rise above that element of my nature and I'm going to do something really good for somebody else at cost to myself. That is growth from the Cassian that we saw in the pilot. It's a natural extension of his personality and his skills, but it is moral and just and good. And I think that's so cool. Who did you pick?
I'm also going to pick Cassian because I admire someone who is able to see the situation to its logical conclusion and act and do it laconically, which Cassian does. He says a lot with mostly actions and few words. And that is less my style, and I kind of wish it was. I've learned to talk my way into and out of situations. That's just what's worked for me, so I keep doing it. I admire that Cassian is someone who acts, and that definitely bites him in the rear a lot, but it's cool.
It also gets him out of a lot of situations that were not his fault with his skin intact, so like, A plus.
You know, whatever it takes to survive, I think, is important. We all learn to survive in various ways, and Cassian is surviving, and but I think that's critical.
He's surviving, which is great. He's also surviving on his own terms, which is also great.
I think if he wasn't surviving on his own terms, he wouldn't be surviving according to his own definition.
Yeah. And right now, his definition includes, I mean, with the example with Skeen, it has to be good for me and it has to be good for the rebellion, too. It has to be good for these good people.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, quickest Baywatch ever. I felt decisive about that one.
Yeah. Shout out to Nemec, though, for doing his job with a broken back.
Shout out to Cinta for being steely-eyed and implacable. Mm-hmm.
Those were both my second place choices, so.
And taps for Lieutenant Gorn. He was rapidly becoming my favorite character of this entire show.
He slayed.
And then was slayed.
Too soon.
Too soon.
Too soon.
Okay. Well, Alexa, play us out with taps. And Baywatch. All right, Sam, what are we watching next week?
Next week, we're watching season one, episode 7 of Andor, Announcement.
Oh, that doesn't sound good.
What? Wasn't that your favorite part of the school day?
That sounds very ominous in context. Announcement is such a banal word, but when I think about the ISB, for example, making an announcement, I don't like that shiz at all.
Well, we've got that. We've got just, so this is the halfway point of Andor. There are 12 episodes. This was episode 6. So we're starting on the second half of Andor next
week. Wow. Mm-hmm. I presume the heist was not everything. So I'm excited to see what happens next. If we were watching Andor in a non-podcast situation, I would have flatly refused to stop at episode 6. I would have immediately turned on episode 7. I am outraged that we didn't get to keep going.
Well, we'll take that outrage, we'll bottle it up, and we'll sell it on the podcast. So find us wherever our new shop of Anna's Outrage is, on all the social media platforms that still exist. Threads, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter.
Kinda.
We're on Twitter.
We're on Twitter. Feels a little bit like a scab move to be on Twitter, but we are at least at the moment on Twitter.
And we're also on Patreon doing Spice Rod.
Yeah, this is a great time to become one of our monthly members on the Patreon. For just $3 a month, or a little bit more if you can give some extra, you can get access to our weekly audio bonus content and our entire backlog of 2 years of really fun, irreverent, profanity-laced hot takes on Star Wars. And right now we're finishing up the 2003 Tartakovsky Clone Wars.
So join us there, join us everywhere, and join us in solidarity by sending this episode to everyone. Get big. Form a groundswell of rebellion, because the message in Rebels that they sent out from the tower hasn't come out yet. But ooh, that is the time frame we are in. This dry tinderbox of fascism has spread throughout the galaxy, and it's time to rise up against this. So send this episode to your friend with a lighter.
Send this episode to your comrades.
We'll catch you next week.
We'll catch you next Tuesday. Bye-bye.